everybody. We're going to begin now. So I'd like to welcome everyone and thank you for being here this evening. I'm glad to say that this is the first lecture of the newly formed University of Toronto chapter of the Thomistic Institute. The Thomistic Institute is an academic institute of the Pontifical Faculty of the Immaculate Conception at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. It exists to promote Catholic truth in our contemporary world by strengthening the intellectual formation of Christians at universities, in the church, and in the wider public square, using the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, the universal doctor of the church, as its touchstone. Tonight's event is being co-sponsored by the McDonald Agape Foundation, encouraging distinguished scholars for Christ. Now it is my great honor to introduce our speaker for this evening, Dr. Sarah Byers. Professor Byers received her PhD right here at the University of Toronto in philosophy and is currently an associate professor of philosophy at Boston College. Her research interests include Augustine, Hellenistic philosophy, the history of ethics, and the history of metaphysics, especially ancient and medieval. She has held research fellowships at the University of Notre Dame, the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies here in Toronto, and at Villanova University. Professor Byers is the author of the book Perception, Sensibility, and Moral Motivation in Augustine, a Stoic-Platonic Synthesis, published by the University of Cambridge Press in 2013. And she has written numerous articles and chapters for publications including the Journal of the History of Philosophy, the Review of Metaphysics, Blackwell's Companion to Augustine, and the Routledge Handbook of the Stoic Tradition. Now, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Professor Byers as she speaks on human freedom and divine grace.
Thank you, Megan, and thank you, everyone. As she mentioned, I did my doctorate here at Toronto, so I feel that U of T is my intellectual home, so I'm very happy to be back. I'm going to just dive in. What I'm going to be presenting is a skeleton excerpted from Chapter 2 and Chapter 7 of my book from 2013. So it's a bit, it could be fleshed out in details in many ways. So when we come to the question period at the end, if you want to ask a question even about what I said on the second slide because you need more examples or something, that's completely normal. So feel very free. So the problem that I want to talk about today is the problem of how human free choice and divine grace are compatible with each other. Human beings naturally have the power of free choice, but deeply ingrained habits cause us to choose in accord with our habits. So how can we ever break out of old habits and form new ones? Augustine's answer to this is that we need divine grace. And specifically, he claims that God must give us two things: the idea or the suggestion to change our lifestyle, and the effective decision to change our lifestyle. But then the question, particularly with regard to the second point, is how are we free in changing our lifestyle? Because if God is giving us the decision itself, it seems he's doing it for us, and maybe we're not doing it. So I'm sure probably most of you, if not all of you, are very familiar with Augustine, but just to introduce him briefly, he's a 4th, 5th century author, and he was born in what is today Algeria, so northeastern Algeria. He was born in Tagaste, and he then studied in Carthage, which is in present-day Tunisia. At that point, he began to live with his girlfriend, and then he was teaching in Tagaste, and then his best friend died, and that pushed him to move. So he went back to Carthage and was teaching in Carthage. And then he decided to move again because the students were late, loud, and they committed vandalism. And this is something you find in Augustine's life when you read the Confessions, is that he experienced providence as something violent, almost like a violent force in his life. It's usually something is going wrong, something he thinks is catastrophically wrong. But afterwards, he looks back on it and says, well, God was moving me from here to here to here to here for specific reasons. So good came out of it. He decided to move again after he got to Rome and was teaching in Rome because there the students didn't pay their tuition bills. And finally, he ends up in Milan. And Augustine says in the Confessions that the purpose of all of these problems was to bring him to Milan, where he would meet Ambrose, the bishop. In Milan, he's an endowed chair of rhetoric, and he has conversion to Christianity there. largely thanks to Ambrose. Then he went back to Tagaste and lived a scholarly ascetical life with his friends, and then was ordained a priest and finally bishop of Hippo Regius. Why is Augustine interested in this problem? Augustine thinks there's empirical evidence that some people, like himself, experience rapid and large-scale moral conversions. These occurrences are not fully explainable as the result of rehabituation or natural qualities in the person, he thinks. He also thinks there's empirical evidence that exceptionally virtuous people exist, like Socrates or Job. The existence of someone like Socrates, who is reputed to be morally superior to his own parents and the entire surrounding society, is problematic. How did he get to be the way he was? Augustine's attempts to explain these kinds of cases cause him to formulate an account of prevenient grace as necessary for moral righteousness. This account becomes a standard account in historical Christianity, with alternative positions being denounced as heresies, Pelagianism and then semi-Pelagianism. Augustine's position is written into church councils, namely the Second Council of Orange and the Council of Trent at the time of the Reformation. So I want to look at the philosophical background to the problem and the way that Augustine sees the problem, and this will also help us to understand how he solves the problem. He's using an epistemology and a moral psychology that synthesizes elements from Stoicism and Platonism. And some of the ancient insights that the Stoics and the Platonists made or had are similar to contemporary findings in psychology. So it has a certain relevance for us today. So I just want to lay out the basic Stoic epistemology that he's going to be using. We should ask what free choice actually is if we're going to be discussing the relation of freedom and grace. So his concept of free choice he takes from the Stoics. And the claim of the Stoics is that human beings are social animals who are rational, and that rationality is distinctive to our species. None of the other species of animals have it, according to the Stoics. This means that we can form concepts, which in philosophy we call universals, right, which are the common properties that many particulars share. And then from multiple concepts, we can form propositions, which are mental sentences in which we assert things about the world, like the tree is green, or it's hot in here, or whatever. And then our rationality also gives us the ability to assent or consent or judge that a proposition is true or that it's false. So just because a thought passes through my mind doesn't mean that I actually am committed to that in the Stoic model. Right? So I think many things, but only some of those things do I assent to or consent to as being true. So free choice, if we want to define it, is assent to the proposition that is contained in what they call a motivating impression. And an impression for the Stoics is the initial perception of a thing or an event. It's passively received and not directly under our control. Humans, unlike other animals, formulate propositions with their impressions. And unlike animals, they can also assent or refuse assent to the proposition that's in the impression. So for example, when I look at the sun from the earth, my impression is that the sun is 1 inch across. That's how it seems to me initially. And because I'm rational, I have that proposition going through my mind. The sun is small. Right? The sun is a small disk. But I don't assent to it, right? And this is the reason why the Stoics posited a distinction between my first impression and assent, because they're aware that humans are available or able to tell the difference between an illusion and reality. So something can appear one way and be a different way. Now, a motivating impression, which is a type of impression that you have when you're exercising free choice, presents an action as worth doing because it's perceived to contribute to happiness somehow. So I think that sweet things contribute to happiness. Generally, there's a background belief that I have. So I see a piece of cake and I have the impression I should eat that cake. So I have the proposition in my mind, it's a good idea to eat the cake. It's fitting to eat the cake. Eating the cake will contribute to my happiness. And again, I can assent or not assent. So there are other types of impressions that are not action-inducing. So if I just think the tree is green, it doesn't motivate me to do anything, right? But the Stoics are trying to explain motivation. So they're trying to account for the fact that, for example, if you and I look at the same glass of wine, let's say we put a glass of wine down in the middle of the room, I look at the wine and I'm motivated to drink it. I pick it up and drink it. And you look at the wine and you're not motivated to drink it. The Stoics say that's because we had two different types of impressions of the same object. So when I saw it, I thought to myself, that looks tasty, I should eat it or drink it. And then when you saw it, you just had a merely epistemic impression. So you just thought, that's wine, or the wine is red. Okay, so similarly with all types of impressions, with an action-inducing impression or a motivating impression, I can either give assent or not. So the concept of temptation, for example, in Christian ascetical literature is really based on the Stoic concept of a motivating impression and their claim that there's a distinction between having the impression that it's a good idea to do something and actually consenting to do it. So this becomes important for the phenomenon of conversion that we're going to be talking about. Now, it gets much more complicated because the Stoics recognize, and Augustine agrees with them, that there's a relationship between our ability to perceive things accurately and our habits. So if I have certain habits, I will perceive things incorrectly. I will have first impressions that are false. And then I will tend to affirm or consent to false propositions, false impressions. So this is an insight that the Stoics take from earlier authors. So Plato, for example, Aristotle, they emphasize the importance of habituation. What I do repeatedly over and over again makes me be a certain type of person. This affects how I perceive the world. And then my ability to choose is limited by how I see things. So if I don't see the glass of wine as enticing, I cannot decide to drink the wine, right? So this causes a problem in the moral life, right? Look at the second bullet point here. If I have a habit of lying around and watching movies, then when someone suggests that I go to the gym and work out, I will perceive going to the gym and working out as something not conducive to my happiness. So I will not have a motivating impression of this. Or if I do have a motivating impression of it, it will be like a weak temptation or a weak suasion toward doing it that I won't decide to do it. I won't affirm that impression. So there are different degrees of habituation that the Stoics recognize. There are less severe diseases, they call them, more advanced sicknesses, or habitual vices. Vices are the deepest type of habit. So relatively shallow dispositions, such as sicknesses, influence or restrict one's perceptions to some limited degree, while the oldest and deepest habits make the resulting impressions practically impossible for the subject to question. For example, someone who's just starting to get into the habit of drinking is inclined to drink more and more, but can still see how drinking might not be in her interest. But a deeply habituated alcoholic believes that her happiness absolutely requires frequent alcohol. And we've all had this experience, right, of forming habits, and then the deeper you get into the habit, the harder it is to change the habit. So Seneca talks about this problem quite extensively, and he's probably the proximate source for Augustine, because in Augustine's sermons, you can see him addressing this problem, and a number of the examples he gives and the metaphors that he uses are also in Seneca. So this second bullet point is a quotation from Seneca's De Ira, his treatise on anger. He says, "Someone whom a slight breeze has made shiver is weak and sickly. Eyes that a white garment offends are not healthy. When pleasures have corrupted both mind and body, nothing seems bearable. Not because things are hard, but because the person experiencing them is soft." So the habits determine how I see things, and they give me a skewed perception. Plato perhaps is more familiar to people than Seneca. Most people have read Plato's Republic at some point in their education, perhaps. And if you think about the allegory of the cave, the most famous section of that book, he talks about pain of the eyes when people are trying to ascend out of the cave, or they're being brought out of the cave by the person who has gone back down to rescue them. And this is a way of talking about the difficulty of seeing that it's better to live in a different way than the way they've been living in the cave. Even though the way they've been living in the cave is a sensory-based kind of life, and they're being called to a higher and better kind of life by the person who's dragging them out of the cave, but they experience it as hard to see that and painful to the mind, right? So what's interesting is that contemporary psychology has been emphasizing the importance of habits as well. So here's a quotation from a book called Making Habits, Breaking Habits from 2013. On average, across the participants who provided enough data, it took 66 days until a habit was formed. As you might imagine, there was considerable variation in how long habits took to form depending on what people tried to do. People who resolved to drink a glass of water after breakfast were up to maximum automaticity after about 20 days, while those trying to eat a piece of fruit with lunch took at least twice as long to turn it into a habit. The exercise habit proved most tricky, with 50 sit-ups after morning coffee still not a habit after 84 days. Although the study only covered 84 days, by extrapolating the curves, it turned out that some of the habits could have taken around 254 days to form. So we're interested in this question, remember, because conversion is changing habits. Conversion is breaking out of an old way of living and moving into a new way of living. So moral virtues and vices are habits. Changing from vice to virtue is a habit change. The key is that the moral virtues really are good for each of us. Each individual, right? They're fulfilling of human nature. They're satisfying for us. They make us healthy and flourishing people. Justice, moderation, courage, and prudence, these are the classical virtues, and they make us happy. But poor habituation will prevent us from seeing the virtues as good for us. So we have a perception problem if we have imperfect or poor habituation. And this leads us to the central problem. How can someone with strong, bad habits ever improve? And Augustine zones right into this, onto this problem. Right? This is exactly what he's interested in. Although we always retain the power of free choice, which is the power to give or refuse assent to our first impression, this power will inexorably be used by an addict to serve her habit. As Augustine puts it in the Replies to Simplicianus, free choice is most important. It exists indeed. But of what value is it in those who are sold under sin? So if I have sinful habits, I'm not going to be able to use it properly in a way that's going to make me happy. Free choice. Now, to really make the problem even more difficult, we have to realize that Augustine thinks that each of us is born with a habit that is thousands of years old. So the condition that he calls original sin, he classifies as a set of ancient desires and age-old evil habits. So consuetudines, habits, this is a technical term in Latin philosophy, meaning a deeply ingrained psychological attitude, mentality, way of seeing the world. It's not a proclivity that can be easily removed. He thinks that the human soul became vicious with the fall. And this condition has the psychological depth and staying power of a habit that is literally thousands of years old. So the problem for Augustine of how to recover from the fallen condition is a specific form of the problem of how to recover from bad habituation. Now, you might think, if you've read Aristotle, well, if you have bad habits, all you need to do is rehabituate yourself, right? You can just form a new habit. It might take 254 days, but you can do it, right? You can eventually do it if you just keep trying and trying again. You can just rehabituate yourself. But this is not going to work, according to Augustine, because we have a practical problem that we have an innate habit that is universal. So every human is born with this thousands of years old habit. And this means that all parenting is dysfunctional and all governing is dysfunctional. So there's no way for children to ever be trained properly. So you have this infinite regress, essentially, of fallen people. I mean, it's not infinite. You stop at the first parents for Augustine. But after that, it's all over, right? Because basically there's moral entropy. So you're habituated by people who are immoral, and then you just kind of continue on this downward path. In the second place, okay, let's suppose that it would be possible to, for parents to be quasi good at what they do, good enough at what they do to give good habits to their kids. The strength of the internal habit of the child is such that he will fail to assimilate the reasons and the motivation for doing the right kinds of deeds. So this means the habituation is going to fail as a moral habituation, right? Because the person will be acting from fear or from force. Certainly if you tell children, right, like if you do that, I'll give you a spanking, or you're gonna get your phone taken away if you do that. Right? So then they will act from fear or from you forcing them through compulsion, through pain, to do it. But this is not the same as moral change, moral rehabituation, right? So they don't actually have a virtuous habit at that point. And Augustine thinks no matter how much from the outside we try to train people, it cannot change the inside because we have this inherited, deep-seated pathology. So to put it in ancient language, right, in order to have a virtue, it's necessary to be acting for the sake of the kalon, or the honestum. In other words, I have to want to do it because it's a morally good thing to do, because I see that it's rational and it's good and it will create flourishing in me and in the wider society. So external habituation cannot really give that to me, is the claim. So let's look at an example. Trying to make humans morally good through habituation alone, for Augustine, would be like taking someone whose habit of gambling is thousands of years old and attempting to make her fiscally prudent. Such a person, so long as she is kept under force or influenced by some powerful deterrent, might gamble little or not at all. But she would abstain from gambling for the wrong reasons and likely turn to some other kind of high-risk, irresponsible behavior. So the motivation would be external and not internal. So this is pretty depressing and also puzzling to think about how this can ever get sorted out. At the theoretical level, all this suggests a hopeless picture in which one's own innate confusion about the proper goal of action and the cumulative mistakes passed on through social customs and amplified through generations are simply overwhelming. Meanwhile, at the empirical level, the existence of someone like Socrates, who was reputed to be morally superior to his own parents and the entire surrounding society, is problematic. How did he get to be the way he was? He should not exist, right, according to this model. Similarly, the existence of people like Augustine himself, who experienced a rapid, large-scale, and lasting moral conversion, is problematic. How could this be possible? So Augustine's solution is that it happens because of divinely given motivation or prevenient grace. Significant change from a state of orientation away from virtues to a state of orientation toward virtues indicates the presence of a supernatural cause and not a natural cause. So as I said earlier, the idea is that naturally things are entropic. So if you're poorly habituated, you act poorly, then you habituate other people poorly and it just keeps going on a downward spiral. In order to explain how that can reverse direction, you really have to appeal to a supernatural cause and not a natural cause. So the way that Augustine puts it is God breathes motivation into the human mind as a gift, as a grace. So his language here, if those things delight us, which serve our advancement towards God, that is inspired and bestowed by the grace of God. This is what he means when he says grace has to be prevenient, okay, coming before. In Latin, coming before, going before, because we need to see virtue as attractive in order to be motivated to act well, but we cannot see it that way because of original sin and our other bad habits. So you have to have the impression given to you by God, the motivating impression. That's the first supernatural thing that has to happen. God has to allow you to see things in a way that's different than the way that your habits enable you to see them. Now, it's more complicated because, as I mentioned in the very first slide, in a number of texts, Augustine also asserts that God not only gives us the idea or suggestion of acting well, but also the effective decision to change our lifestyle. So his claim is that we are so deeply habituated to vice after the fall that God also needs to give us consent to the impression. So if you think back to the Stoic epistemology, there were two stages, right? You have the impression, and then you have to assent to it or not. You can choose, right? Augustine thinks God has to give us the first impression that the virtuous act is a good thing to do that will make us happy, and then he also has to give us the consent itself to the impression, the decision. Okay, so that takes us to the real problem, right? If God is giving us consent or decision, then how are we free? How are we freely acting? Because we've said free choice is the ability to say yes or no to impressions. That's how we defined it initially in the Stoic model. And now he's saying God is giving us that response to the impression. So is this free choice? If we look at the conversion scene in the Confessions in Book 8, he describes a three-step process, if you look at it very carefully. First, he describes himself receiving this divinely given suggestion or first impression. So he says God acts on his mind to cause him to see the Christian life as attractive. And the way he does this in the text is through metaphor. So he says, continence was appearing to me as if beckoning me to come forward. Right? So continence is a lifestyle. It's a set of actions. It's a way of acting and living. And he's saying God gave him the ability for the first time to see that as attractive. Because when you read the Confessions up to that point, he keeps saying, Alypius was not addicted to sex, but I was. So Alypius couldn't see why I thought I couldn't live without sex. So he's perceiving that he needs sex for happiness and that giving it up is completely incompatible with happiness. But at this moment in Confessions 8, all of a sudden he sees it differently. And he says, continence was appearing to me as attractive, as beckoning. But you see then in the Confessions that he doesn't immediately decide to become a Christian and to live continently. And what happens in the text is that he says he compares this attractive vision or the perception of continence that he has, which is attractive, he compares that to his own lifestyle, the way he's been living. He reflects on himself. And he says he sees his soul lacerated by wounds, and then he's overcome by sorrow and wants to change, right, his life. And at that point, he does something. He invokes God, and he says he calls on God to help him. And then you see the decision happening. It's a third thing that happens. God effects the decision in him, basically. This is the famous Tole Lege passage where he hears a child singing, pick up and read, and he picks up the Bible and reads the text of Romans, and then by the time he finishes reading the sentence, he has assented to change his lifestyle. And even the text of Romans that he reports reading is it's action-oriented. So it's put on the Lord Jesus Christ, give up your licentious way of life, your drunkenness, whatever. Paul is listing sins and exhorting people to give up a sinful way of life and to enter the church through baptism. So when he reads that proposition in the Bible, it affects the assent in him, in his mind. So it's presented as the word of God. It's presented as the action of God in his mind. So God is doing the decision for him or with him or enabling him to do it. So in this model of the Confessions, you can see that the exercise of freedom in his conversion happens at the second stage, right? Because he receives the impression from God, and then he's stuck, essentially. He sees the attractive action. He feels unable to decide to do it. He looks at himself and sees that he's a wreck and a mess. And then he asks God for help. So the invocation is what he contributes to the conversion process. But the invocation is just, God, help me, I can't do anything, basically. Okay, so I call this a dialogue model of justification because God initiates, the person then calls out for help, God then gives the decision. So I'm going to read an example from one of his sermons where he is describing this process. And because he's working with the text of the Psalms, it's all in metaphor because he's preaching from the text that's given in the Psalms. So he's going to be, the Psalm verse talks about the earth, and for Augustine, that's going to represent the human soul. It talks about the heavens dripping or raining down, and Augustine interprets this as grace coming down to water the earth, which is the soul. And then growing weak is when Augustine uses to talk about this receptivity to grace, the second step that you see in the confessions, not rebelling against the first grace, but asking God for help. And then bringing forth fruit is his way of referring to the third step, the decision to live a morally good lifestyle. So this is quite beautiful. This is one of the sermons that was most recently discovered of Augustine by Dolbeau. The Lord will grant sweetness, and our earth shall produce its fruit. Where would this fruit come from unless the Lord gave sweetness? You can see how our earth, that is to say our hearts, our souls, how our earth does not give its fruit unless God sends rain on it. The earth was moved. It was moved to bring forth, to give birth. So then, the earth was moved, for indeed the heavens dripped from the face of God. It was moved by God, because it would not have been moved except by a voluntary rain. So then, setting apart, O God, a voluntary rain for your inheritance, and it grew weak. One who brings forth also grows weak. The earth, you see, was moved in order to bring forth, and it would not bring forth unless it first grew weak. You, however, have perfected it. What does grew weak mean? Did not rely on itself. What does grew weak mean? Hoped for everything from you. Let it cry out, weak as it is, to the Lord. Convert us, God of our healings. It understood it could not be perfected by itself. So what's interesting here is that he actually says it's a necessary condition for the third step that the person invokes God and grows weak. So you get the idea that God gives the first movement or the first impression, and if the person does not yield or grow weak or ask for help from God to decide, then that will be the end of the story. But if the person does exercise their freedom to ask God for more help, then God will give them the decision to bring forth. Okay, so the last thing I want to do, and this is really, we're getting to the end. I want to make a connection to the early modern debates that occurred at the time of the Reformation in Europe about the relationship of efficacious grace and human free will. So at the time of the Reformation, various theories about the relation of grace and freedom were debated. For example, Luther and Calvin rejected the idea that grace reconciled fallen humans to God by an interior renovation of being made just. In other words, by a quality of the soul of the person himself. So this is sometimes called the theory of the imputation of righteousness, understanding justification as an imputation of righteousness rather than an internal infused change. Calvin denied also that humans could reject justifying grace, and Luther held that God does not require human beings to reciprocate God's gifts in order to continue receiving Christ and his benefits. Jansen argued that God gives humans an overwhelming feeling of delight, which irresistibly makes them want to become Christian and change their lifestyle to accord with Christian morality. Molina claimed that God gives human beings a very persuasive suggestion that they should become Christian, but when people decide to follow this suggestion, it is by their own power of free choice acting alone. And Banez said that God gives humans an attractive suggestion that they should become Christian, and in response, humans can either reject the idea immediately and refuse to think about it further, or not reject it. If they do not reject it, then God rewards them with a second grace, the grace of decision. So let's take a vote. How many people want to vote for Banez? 4 or 5 people. Okay. Who else has votes? Jansen? Anyone going for Jansen? Okay. A couple of people. How about Luther and Calvin? No? Molina? One person. Okay. And a bunch of people are just hedging their bets, being safe. Okay, so the interesting thing is that all of these authors claim to be inspired by Augustine. They're all saying, we are faithful to the patristics, we are faithful to Augustine, he's the doctor of grace, we're the true Augustinians. Luther and Calvin, if you read them, they claim that they're returning to the primitive church, right? That they are rescuing Christians from the corruptions of medieval scholasticism by returning back to the patristic era. Jansen, Molina, and Banez were all Catholics, but they have these different views. They don't agree with one another. Jansen actually wrote a book called Augustinus, attempting to set out Augustine's theology of the fall and grace. So he's claiming that everything he says is directly inspired by Augustine. Molina and Banez are particularly interesting because they represented the Jesuits and the Dominicans respectively in what we call the De Auxiliis Papal Commission. So this lasted from 1582 to 1607. And this, the Pope asked, essentially, the Jesuits and Dominicans, the best representatives of each side, to publicly debate in his presence about the relationship between grace and free choice. And this is because Trent, the Council of Trent, says that grace must be prevenient. It follows Augustine as saying grace must be prevenient, but it also claims against the Reformers that humans cooperate in their own justification. So then there was a fight amongst the Catholics about how to understand this and tease this out. And we have two different positions, Molina and Banez. So again, both Molina and Banez are claiming that they're Augustinian. Okay, so they allude to themselves as Thomists sometimes, and they quote Aquinas sometimes, but they're assuming that Augustine and Aquinas agree substantially and that they are the true Augustinians. Okay, so what I think is that Banez is actually closest to Augustine's view, at least the view of Augustine that we get in the Confessions and that sermon that I showed you, which is just one example of many, where you have this dialogue model, right? So first of all, when you look at the Dominican texts, Banez and then Herrera is another one, who's a contemporary of Banez, they just quote Augustine more than the Jesuit side does. So that's the first hint that the Dominicans are actually closer to the classical patristic view. And then Banez, his position is very close to the dialogue model. So what he says is, first of all, conversion is effected by God acting directly on the mind of the person. And he calls this physical causality, but he doesn't mean by physical that the human mind is material. It's not material for him. But he's saying this to distinguish his position from Molina, because Molina talks about moral suasion, which is a weaker type of causality. It's just like God entices with this suggestion, like the impression in the Stoic model. And what Banez wants to say is God directly acts on the soul. He's not just persuading from the outside. He also claims, like Augustine, that there are two graces, only the second of which is intrinsically efficacious. So it's possible to reject the first grace, according to Banez, but you cannot reject the second grace, according to Banez. Where Augustine speaks of becoming weak and invoking God after the first grace of impression as something different from assent or decision to the impression, Banez also says that after the first grace, we can not reject it without actually assenting to it. So you can do this intermediate thing. They also agree on the notion of free will, Augustine and Banez, that it's an instrument to be used to choose the good, not an absolute good in itself. So Molina claimed that free choice is always able to do otherwise, even when it's being acted on by God. So he thought that we had to say that basically God's incapable of acting on us with physical causality in an intrinsically efficacious way, right, in order to preserve free choice. And both Augustine and Banez reject that. They basically just say God gave us free choice in order to get us to happiness if we're so messed up with bad habits that we cannot use it to get us where we want to go, then God is helping our free choice if he gives us good decisions to go in the right direction. So it's not in conflict with free choice. So Molina's account of free choice is really kind of the crux of the difference between the classical patristic model you find in the Dominicans and the Jesuits. And the Dominicans accuse the Jesuits of being modernistas, modernists about free choice. So here's a quote from Banez. Around this turns the entire difficulty and controversy between the preacher fathers and the fathers of the society. Whether the same prevenient grace, without another one added to it, suffices for the consent of free choice and the conversion to God, or whether another aid is added by which the mind of man actually consents to God and is converted to him. So the Jesuit position, specifically Molina, he's talking about here, is that God just gives you this suasion and your response is entirely from yourself. Your decision is entirely from yourself. And Banez is saying, we don't agree with that. We think God gives us the decision itself, the second, as a second grace. So lastly, I thought I would just end with a quote from Aquinas, since this is the Thomistic Institute. And we can ask the question, how close Banez and Augustine are to Aquinas, or how close Aquinas is to Augustine and Banez. So he says in the first part of the second part of the Summa, grace is fittingly divided into operating and cooperating. In that effect in which our mind is moved and does not move, but in which God is the sole mover, the operation is attributed to God, and it is with reference to this that we speak of operating grace. But in that effect in which our mind both moves and is moved, the operation is not only attributed to God, but also to the soul. And it is with reference to this that we speak of cooperating grace. Now there is a double act in us. First, there is the interior act of the will. And with regard to this act, the will is a thing moved, and God is the mover. And especially when the will, which hitherto willed evil, begins to will good. And hence, inasmuch as God moves the human mind to this act, we speak of operating grace. But there is another exterior act, and since it is commanded by the will, the operation of this act is attributed to the will. And because God assists us in this act, both by strengthening our will interiorly so as to attain to the act, and by granting outwardly the capability of operating, is respect to this that we speak of cooperating grace. So it's pretty clear to me at any rate that when he's speaking of operating grace, he's talking about the moment of decision in conversion, and then cooperating grace, he's talking about when we actually walk to the church to be baptized in the case of Augustine. Like when you actually do an action that follows from that moment of conversion, this requires only cooperating grace. But the moment of conversion, changing from evil to good, he says operating grace. So, I'm sorry. So, as you can see, my thesis is that the Dominicans had the best understanding of Augustine and also of Aquinas, because Aquinas essentially follows Augustine. So, that's it. Thank you very much. So, we can open it up for questions if people have questions or comments. Yes, Juliana.
It's a loose recollection, maybe I'm wrong, that there is Elaine Augustine who is much more emphatic on predestination. I mean, would your view still apply to his works professively on predestination?
Right, okay, so I avoided talking about the late works because he changes his position. This is how I read Augustine, that he changes his position. So what I presented was the middle period position of the Confessions, Replies to Simplicianus, Sermons, and Orationes. And some of the anti-Pelagian works have this dialogue model as well, but in the last 5 years of his life, he basically says everything is operating grace. Every good thing we do is by what Aquinas calls operating grace. And there will be a problem with the omnipotence of God if he's giving us only a weak grace, a cooperating grace. So, yes, that the Calvinists like that period of Augustine. So part of the problem with the Reformation debates and the Counter-Reformation Catholic attempts to respond is that they treat Augustine's corpus as this monolithic thing, but the same position on grace throughout the whole period, and it's just not true. So he becomes very hardcore at the end of his life and kind of rejects the dialogue model, or at least ceases talking about it. Even in the middle period, he has, alongside the dialogue model, he does talk about the cases of people like Paul, who just seem to be struck with one grace that immediately converts them, that's intrinsically efficacious. So I think he's getting that idea in epistemological terms from the notion of like a self-evident, seeing something as being self-evident and true. And so he thinks that like for some special cases, God gives people this perception of something as self-evidently true. And they don't have this hesitation in asking for more help. But I think he thinks God only does that, at least in his middle period, he thinks God only does that when the person has a specific mission in the church and it serves some purpose. But the normal way that God operates is in the dialogue model. Again, that's his middle period of writings. Yes?
In one of your earliest slides, you had the phrase on there, what was it, the motivating impulse, when you're talking
impression.
Motivating impression.
Yes.
When you're talking about the Stoics. There's a word missing in there, and I'm curious if it's in Augustine or not, propasio.
Mm-hmm.
Liam's laughing because they just talked a little bit about this a few days ago. Didymus the Blind.
Yes.
Speaks of propadia,
uh-huh.
and sort of the origin in
yes.
their use of Stoics. Does Augustine?
Yes, he does. Yeah, so I published an article on this, actually.
Okay.
And it's also in my book, I talked about it. So he does, because he's read Seneca, the De Ira,
mm-hmm.
and in the sermons, especially, is where you see him advising people not to transition into full-blown anger. And he lays it out that you have a first impression, and it's like a little shoot that can grow into a tree, but you want to prevent it from growing into a tree. A lot of the metaphors he uses are taken from Seneca. So a lot of the fathers of the church use the preliminary passions, which is a first reaction to the first impression. So, for example, if someone cuts me off in traffic, I have a first impression, I've been done an injustice. So I will have a little beginning of anger, they call it. But I can still assent or not. So I can tell myself, oh, it's not the end of the world, nothing really important happened, I shouldn't be angry. So this first beginning of anger or beginning of whatever emotion it is, they call that a preliminary passion. And a lot of the fathers of the church use that concept to explain, for example, things like Christ being afraid of death in the Garden of Gethsemane, because it says he began to be afraid. So they say, it was just a preliminary passion. He was never really afraid to die. And this comes from Stoicism, yeah. So Augustine also obviously talks about it in City of God, Book 9. And then the question there is, the language is tricky, because he's also arguing that we don't need to use technical terminology, but we preserve the concept. So he is agreeing with them that there are preliminary passions there, but some authors like Sarabji have tried to say, well, we didn't understand preliminary passion, because he used the word passio instead of, he was actually say the word propasio, or propatea, there. So he, yeah, we can talk about it more later. But
okay.
He says, like, it's a posture in the animus and not in the mens. That's how he defines
okay.
it. So Gellius mm-hmm. also does that, and Seneca also does that. That there's a movement in the animus, but there's no consent with the mens, mm-hmm. with the mind. Someone else? Yes.
Thanks, I really enjoyed the talk. Learned a lot.
Thank you.
I really liked the three-step model that you gave.
Yes.
Suggestion, invocation, and decision. And I'm wondering a bit about the relationship between those steps. And I'm worried in particular about the relationship between suggestion and invocation.
Okay.
I'm worried because philosophers these days are concerned about finding room for control in free decision, and I'm wondering if there's room for control in the move from suggestion to invocation.
Okay. Yeah, so it's a good question. So the reason why we think these are three discrete events or acts is that the impression that's given by God, he thinks, is not the impression that I should invoke God. It is the impression that I should change my lifestyle and decide to be a Christian, whatever. So I don't assent to that. Then the invocation, at least in this period of his writing, seems to just come from me. So I form the impression that I ought to ask God for help because it's in my interest to do so. So it's true that it happens as one of the consequences of having that first impression given.
Yeah.
But it's not even about the same matter. Like they're not. When you assent, you have to assent to do any kind of action. So to invoke God, you have to assent to the question. It's a good idea for me to invoke God for help, but God's not proposed to you to do that.
Right. I guess my worry is it seems that invocation is sufficient for decision, and I'm wondering whether suggestion is sufficient for invocation.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
But not in the sense that... Okay, wait, maybe I want to say it's necessary. Yeah, so it doesn't, you won't automatically do it if you have the impression.
Yeah.
Is that good to what you were asking?
Yeah, I think so. And then I guess then my worry is, I'm worried about a dilemma. Because if it's necessary and not sufficient, suggestion to invocation.
Yeah.
And I'm worried that we merit the
invocation
that we look like a Pelagian.
Yeah.
Which we don't want to look at.
Right. Okay, so this is part of the reason why he's in such a hardened position, because he feels that he has to explain why we invoke. Right. And so then he starts off saying, oh, well, that must be a weak breach that God is cooperating with us. But then later on, he worries about the omnipotence of God, and he says, basically, why would God give me weak graces, or how can we say that we could say no to the grace of God? So he makes it all operating.
Yeah.
So it is a bit of a dilemma, in a way, but I'm not quite sure that the solution of saying everything is operative grace is any better.
Any last questions?
You can ask anything about us, and we can just discuss it. It doesn't have to be about the presentation. Yes.
So, can you inherit operating grace but not actually transition to action, so to speak? And what would stop you from actually going to the next stage of cooperating grace?
I don't think that either of them, like, once, if you're given a decision, you will carry out the action unless you're impeded somehow.
So, it naturally follows from this?
Yes.
Okay.
It is sufficient. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
This way, Bonnie, it's called it intrinsically efficacious.
Okay.
Yeah. The reason I hesitated about the first impression, and I said, at first I said, yes, sufficient, well, maybe I only want to say that's necessary, is because the way Banya's quote said is the first phrase is sufficient in the sense that it's enough for you to not reject it or do this yielding thing, which is basically just entertaining it without affirming it. So because Molina was saying that grace of impression is sufficient in the sense that it's all you need to give a decision, to consent. Yes,
ma'am. Is prevenient grace available to everyone? Was it available?
He never commits himself to that.
Even before Christ? Or how do you explain
it? It is available before Christ. So he talks specifically.
Socrates' case is a result of that, right?
What's that?
The Socrates' case, then.
Yes, exactly, in Job.
Yeah.
So he specifically talks about Job in the commentary on John's Gospel. Saying that grace was present there, but it was like rain on fleece. So people couldn't see it, but it was acting. In other words, there were no sacraments, there were no external signs of it. Yes, so that's how he doesn't directly address the case of Socrates, but other early fathers do think that people like Plato and Aristotle and Plotinus had special graces that they received.
It doesn't have to, this is not about salvation, yet, but this is only about. Or is it?
Well, you don't really have a clear distinction between like limbo and heaven here. So for Augustine, it's really all about moral conversion, which is really indistinguishable from union with God. And so if you are, I mean, grace is transformative. And if you truly love the good for its own sake or the colon for the sake of the colon, you would have to have been justified, according to Augustine. You would have had to be turned in the right direction. At least at this stage. What's that?
So Socrates is saying
that? Job. He says this about Job. So I think Socrates is a similar type of case, but he never directly says it, so I don't want to attribute it to him. But he does say Job was not even an Israelite. So he is a pagan, same as Socrates. So yeah, why not? Is there anything?
I forget what I was going to say something.
Okay. Yes.
How do you verify grace rationally? Like, how can you determine that, in fact, it is grace,
right,
but logically articulated so that it's objective?
Uh-huh. So, this is a good question, and if you read, for example, like, The Life of Anthony by Athanasius, this is one thing that early Christians grapple with, because they say, well, these suggestions, these first impressions, actually, demons could give them to us as well. Right? So demons can't make us assent or make decisions. So you require the power of God to actually cause a faculty to do something in a human. But the suggestion of an impression, an idea, is something that even a demon could do. Angels can give us good ones, demons can give us bad ones. So, but it'd be fairly easy to see where they're coming from by looking at the content of them, at least if it's about a moral issue. So clearly, like for Augustine anyway, the demons are always trying to entice you to do simple things, whereas the angels are only going to be suggesting good things to do. And so you just look at the propositional content of the impression, and then you can judge it objectively according to like the Ten Commandments or the Beatitudes or something.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, so this question doesn't necessarily have to do with grace.
Okay.
But after the conversion process in Augustine,
mm-hmm.
cultivating virtuous habits, does he talk at all about the role of biblical reading and biblical study in the cultivation of those habits? I'm thinking primarily, for example, like in John Cash and in his conferences. So these intellectuals, they all were well-versed in the classical literature. You know, Augustine was a big fan of Cicero. Cashin talks about when he's at prayer, he often finds it difficult for him to not think about classical poetry, for example, and some of this literature. And the Abba, I think it's Paphnutius, I can't remember who he's talking to here, says, read more scripture. The more you read it, the more you will cultivate an attitude and mental habits, particularly mm-hmm. regarding the biblical text.
Yes.
Does Augustine at
yes.
all get into that?
Definitely, yeah. So part of the Stoic theory of the passions and the impressions and whatever is that you build virtue by habitually questioning your first impressions and revising that, right, and never giving assent to falsehood. And so they have various therapies for how people are supposed to go about doing that, right? And Augustine takes the therapies that he sees in Seneca and then he adds to them. So one of the therapies he adds is continuous meditation on the law.
Okay.
And by the law, he just means meditation on scripture. So he talks about, like, we're like ants. We should be like ants that are constantly carrying things around from place to place to build their house. And the thing we should be carrying is the scripture in our mind. He talks about ruminating, about chewing it over and over. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and part of the reason he is, when he's saying the law, he thinks the moral content of these pagan classical virtues is the same as the content of the Ten Commandments, and the Beatitudes are implications from the Ten Commandments. They're just additional implications. So the pagans don't act virtuously not because they have the wrong idea of what the virtues are, but because they haven't been turned around interiorly, so they're actually doing it from the wrong motive, he thinks. So, I mean, his famous example is the Romans. They just want to look good, and this is why they care about being brave. You know. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about how these graces change after the sacrament of baptism?
He doesn't have a detailed taxonomy of grace like you find in Aquinas, right, where you've got actual grace and habitual grace and different types of habitual and actual. So, for example, one interesting thing was I looked for this question, right, because this is relevant to the Reformation debate as well, the distinction between justification and sanctification. So I looked to see, like, does he ever say that it's better to receive communion every day than just on Sundays, for example, and I couldn't find anything like that. So all the emphasis is on baptism and then ruminating on scripture and living according to the Christian way of life, but you don't have much of an account of how to build up grace in you, at least not sacramentally, in Augustine. But I'm also not an expert in ascetical church history, so to what extent daily communion was available to the laity?
It wasn't.
Okay,
yeah.
There you go. But you still would expect him to say, like, well, the priest has a better deal.
It's a bit of it in his Eucharistic theology, but
uh-huh.
I was wondering if you knew anything about the baptism, because I haven't been able to find it either. So.
Okay, yeah, I haven't found anything. Prayer, right? So he talks about praying daily and things. Did you have anything?
Yeah. If I may,
yes.
Could I pose a question regarding the conception of the soul in Augustine?
Sure.
According to you, does Augustine make a significant difference between anima and animum?
So he knows that in philosophical language they mean two different things. So anima is a soul for any type of animal or even a plant. And so he's not going to use the word animus, which is rational soul, to talk about the other animals or plants. But in, like, when he's preaching on the Psalms, it says anima many places. It's translated, at least in his Latin translation of the Greek Psalms. So, and it's clearly talking about humans, right? So he uses the word anima sometimes to also refer to rational souls. If he's commenting on a text that has that word in it, he's not going to change the word of scripture. Is that getting to your question or no?
Yeah, and then when he uses anima, he's referring to what Greek? Greek word?
Psuche. Psuche.
And the animus?
So animus would be depending on like which Latin author you're talking about, right? It could be nous, could be you know, it's a cane, right? Like the thinking thing, right? The thing that thinks.
I mean, I know this is a complex.
It's what?
A complex subject.
Uh-huh.
With words and because sometimes anima and animus, the meanings get a longer time they get mixed.
Right. So it's like animus is very clearly about rationality, you can just translate it as mind, right? Whereas in Augustine you have, so in terms of, in the City of God, for example, in the philosophical writings, how does he tend to normally speak? People say the first impression is in the animus. In other words, it's something that involves rationality. But the ability to assent to it is a higher power, which is in the mens. So he signals this distinction between higher and lower rational powers by animus and mens. But then again, mens is in the animus for Augustine, because animus refers to the whole rational soul as well. So. Yes?
How much of a role does knowledge play in Augustine's position or account of moral motivation and moral conversion?
So, knowledge of what?
Well, say, for the Stoic, he's working with Stoic, I guess, moral psychology. So, for them, I suppose, like, you assent to any given motivating impression because of your beliefs, which constitute your disposition to assent or something like that. So, like a conversion, there would be some change in your knowledge set, or what you believe, or how strongly you believe,
okay.
Or something like that.
Yeah, so this could bring
maybe
some, ultimately, in Stoicism, the reason that we have motivating impressions is because of oikeusis, which is that all animals have an orientation to what's helpful for them, specific to their species. So virtues are part of what's healthy for us as humans, because virtuous behaviors are rational behaviors, and we're rational. So mental health requires that we do virtuous actions, right? So it's not just beliefs, is what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
It's this automatic recognition that we have that certain things are good for us, helpful for us.
Okay.
So that can be distorted through habituation.
Okay.
And then I acquire false beliefs about what's actually good for me. And I think, like, pleasure is what makes me happy.
Yeah. So then you have to change your beliefs in order to kind of front. Like,
well, this
just
is
a purely Stoic account.
This is why, no, I think he, I mean, so if you read Seneca, Seneca says we're all born to sin.
Okay.
I mean, peccato, moral error, however you want to translate
it
in Seneca.
Yeah.
So he sees the same problem. Like, it's just, so society's corrupt, and we have a tendency to all turn out badly, and virtuous people are as rare as the phoenix, which was a mythical bird. So.
Yeah.
So Augustine sees himself as just providing a solution to the problem that Seneca identifies and a lot of ancient authors identify. And, I mean, Plato says in the Republic about, that's how I got the Socrates example, is actually from Plato, because he says, you know, not specifically about Socrates by name, but it's implied that it's about Socrates, right? Because they're discussing the ideal Republic, and then they say, well, but this is an ideal, and if anyone were to appear today who became a philosopher king, a virtuous soul, it can only be that divine dispensation, same way. So, this way I feel justified in sneaking Socrates in, even though Augustine never directly says. Yes, if anyone needs to leave, please feel free to leave. I feel like you're all trapped in this narrow alley. Good to see you. Yes?
So, do you know where, what Erasmus's opinion was, like, in relation to the author you mentioned?
Say again?
Like, where does Erasmus stay, like, in his way? Because he has a very strong opinion also about free will, right? What kind of differs with Luther?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on Erasmus, so why don't you give us a summary and then I can tell you.
Oh, it's a question.
Okay. I haven't paid a lot of attention to Erasmus. Yeah. I mean, this is material from my book in which I basically was looking at Bindusonia and Jackson. So I just didn't.
Hey, you mentioned somebody, Catholic Albert also shot. Maybe you knew also.
Right, yeah, I mean.
Maybe the earlier authors, or before Trent.
Right, yeah, I can't claim to be able to talk about that. Yes?
Going back to the culinary passions.
Yeah.
I was thinking about been reading City of God and the idea of passion in 9 and 14 seem like
yeah.
different, where 9 is like, you know, passion is what it's waiting outside of you that you have sent to, and then 14 is like your will, it's kind of already there. Like,
yeah.
Passions, and is that, like, is it just, oh, he didn't say it, but these are culinary passions and these are passions?
Yeah.
Or is it?
So, yeah, book 9, 5, I mean, so I've also written on this, and this is my interpretation of the in book 9-5, he is agreeing that there are such things as preliminary passions. He just says, why should we have to call them by a special name? The important thing is it's anonymous and not meant. In other words, the person who might give consent to the false proposition. Then in book 14, when he's saying that stuff about the will, my interpretation is, first of all, will in Augustine, she's translating horme, which you find in Cicero and also Seneca sometimes. So the meaning of it is stoic impulse, and then the stoics have two different forms, they have occurrent and dispositional. So in book 14, when he's saying our emotions come out of our will, he's talking about our habitual horme, impulse. So my acquired tendency to do certain kinds of actions explains why I have emotional reactions, partly explains why I have emotional reactions I do, because I value a set of objects that are attained through doing certain types of actions that I've repeatedly done. Therefore, when I see one of the things, these things threatened, I have an emotional response because I believe that it's important for my happiness. Yeah, that's a tricky passage, yeah. I mean, certainly, like, very different. If Aquinas were to say that, right, it would mean an emotion is an act of the will, and it would have a very different meaning, but I think it's just a dispositional impulse in Augustine. That's the sense in that passage. Yes,
I have a question about original sin, because
okay.
I worry about that sometimes.
Sure.
So it seems to me that three conditions are sufficient for me being damned. Adam sins, God doesn't give me forgiving grace,
yeah.
and God doesn't have to give me forgiving grace.
Right.
None of those conditions are up to me.
Right.
Let's say they're all true.
Yeah. yeah.
How is that just?
Right, so I talked about this also in my book. And basically, Augustine just accepts a theory of corporate responsibility for the fall. So he thinks we were all in Adam in some real sense that can be cashed out as responsibility. And it's not that satisfying. He tries to explain the mechanics of it by talking in a literal commentary on Genesis about spiritual matter of the soul that we inherit from our parents, which is different from our mind, which is the form of our soul, which is put directly into us by God when we begin to exist. That's all. It's just a biblical notion of corporate responsibility. It's like Israel is one agent in the face of God, like in terms of relating to God in some sense, right? So Adam had this representative function. Who's kind of like representing all of humanity, so we all stand with him.
Right.
Is that philosophically plausible?
it's definitely not satisfying. I mean, the easiest way out of that dilemma is to deny, a trilemma, is to deny that God doesn't give forgiving grace to everyone. And so Augustine never asserts that that's false, he just doesn't affirm it. Because I think he doesn't see scriptural warrant for affirming it. So he thinks we can't know. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Maybe another person said that a later period he changes his mind about the grace problem.
Yes.
And I was wondering which text, like, so the City of God?
No, not that late. So Synagogue was written over like 20 years.
Okay.
But the works that are specifically about grace, so for example, the work called On Grace and Free Choice, which was written like in the last, all these things were written in the last 7 years of his life, Against Julian, On Grace and Free Choice, On Adulterous Marriages. They're like off the top of my head. You can find it. Just look at a chronological list of Gustin's works and everything in the last 6-7 years of his life that has to do with grace.
Yeah, and I was wondering whether you find the middle period theory of grace more attractive or
mm-hmm.
persuasive
mm-hmm.
than the later period?
Yes.
Is your personal theme?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't actually think there's a problem with God giving people just like one wacko operating grace if there's some reason behind it. Like, so Augustine seems to think in the middle period that the case of Paul is like that. So because Paul had this special mission to be an instrument to convert the Gentiles, then God just gives him this self-evidently compelling, true impression of the Christian life, and he's just immediately changed, and he doesn't have this. It's not an impression only, it's not a weak impression that you can doubt or you can not assent to. You just see it as self-evident. I don't think there's a problem with that in terms of free choice, because it's the same type of grace that occurs in the second grace in the Banyas and Augustine's middle period model. And as long as there's a reason why God is doing that, so it's not just random or arbitrary, it doesn't really bother me. But I think it's problematic to say grace has to be that way. Otherwise, it's a problem with God's omnipotence. I just think that doesn't follow at all. But Augustine kind of becomes worried about that at the end of his life. Yeah. It's also a question of how fallen you think we are. Like, if you think that we're so corrupt that even if God gives us a first impression, we do not have the intrinsic goodness left in us to be able to call out for more help, then you're going to say, like, we're basically purely passive. But I think, I mean, that's what Trent is trying to argue against. Someone else with their hand up in the back. I think. Yeah? Yes.
Anyone can answer me?
Yes.
Am I going to walk because I'm not sure this is a good question. It might be realistic, but so from what I understood your presentation, it seems like for Augustine, we have these bad habits, like right from conception, and then that changes our perception. So I'm wondering how that change in our perception could be reconcilable with this idea of the natural law that like, we all have like access by the love of reason to certain virtues. So I'm sure it's reconcilable, I just don't know how.
Right, so he does talk in his sermons. He says essentially what Aquinas says later. If you look at the part of the Summa where Aquinas is asking, I think the objection is we don't need a divine law because we have natural law. So why would God need the Ten Commandments when we can just figure out the virtues ourselves? And Aquinas' answer is through bad habits, our ability to reason is impeded, or there might be a evil disposition of nature, you know, if I have a biochemical problem or something. And of course, he's in the original sin, right? It's part of that. So, Augustine says the same thing in one of his sermons. So, he uses the word natural law, because that comes from the Stoicism as well, through Cicero. And he says, that humans have a natural law written in their hearts, but because they didn't listen to God, God had to then give us the Ten Commandments, right? So, this is the difference, I think, between Augustine's middle period and late period, where you get this idea at the end that we're just kind of so corrupt that we couldn't even invoke God after we receive a grace kind of thing. So at that point, he never explicitly says like the natural law is completely blotted out of our hearts, but you do get the sense that he thinks that we're so corrupted that we cannot we can't perceive anything correctly at all, really, without these operating graces in the moral sphere. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, so just to follow, so in the middle period, the sense of our, the degree of our corruption is sort of like, we got a little bit of Jekyll, a little bit of Hyde.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't want to say anything else about it. But if you want to say something.
No, that reminded me of a question I wanted to ask. From your second slide and the way you talked about original sin, it almost made it sound like Augustine thinks that as the generations pass from like Adam to Noah to Abraham to Jacob to David, so on and so forth, original sin's getting worse and worse.
And societal customs are getting more rough. Yeah.
That's just true.
Yeah.
This is my third question, so I'm sorry if anybody has any questions that I want to forward, but in Country Kelso, Origen responds to a critique from Kelsus, who says basically, if your God is omnipotent, why didn't he just, snap his finger and make people change? And his response, Origen's response was, well, virtue not freely chosen isn't virtue.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to figure out here this operating grace. Because part of it sounds a little bit like, for Augustine anyway, the conversion that happens and the virtue which comes after, it really isn't freely chosen. It sounds almost like it's coerced.
So this is the point I was making about it depends what you think free choice is.
Yeah.
So Molina wants to say that. And this is
Molina wants to say that it's coercion?
Yeah, but it would be coercion if God were to give us an intrinsically efficacious grace of decision. But Banez is rejecting that because his view of free choice is basically the same as Augustine's, which is that it's a power that has a purpose to it, so it's for the sake of becoming happy. Just like your legs are for walking, so if you're born without legs and God gives you a wheelchair, you would just be thrilled. I mean, it would be great. You wouldn't say, you're violating my nature, because there's something wrong with you, and he's just restoring what was lost to you, essentially. So you're made to choose the right thing, but then you got sick, you got ruined, and he's just giving you medicine. The basic way that Augustine thinks of grace is medicinal. There's something wrong with you, and he's fixing. So it's a, if you go to the later medieval period, and even Banez and other parts of Banez's corpus, you have this other idea, right, that grace is giving us a second end or a supernatural end, and that's different from just healing nature. But in Augustine, what you get is grace is medicinal for our nature. It's just healing us. Yes.
So grace is medicinal, but it's applied very randomly.
Well, he doesn't ever want to say God is random. He just says, there's a reason why God does what he does, but we don't know what it is. We can't figure it out. Right?
It's a mystery.
What's that?
It's a mystery.
We
can't comprehend. It goes back to this whole thing in, the Trinity with the idea of, the little kid dumping the sand, trying to get the water out of the ocean, and Augustine goes, why are you trying to do that? What are you doing? And the kid goes, why are you trying to understand God?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely committed to the position that God is rational. I don't say rational, but eminently reasonable, right? So there's a reason why he does what he does, but we just can't figure it out sometimes. So he's never going to say grace is arbitrarily given to people.
How does his eminent God's presumed eminent reasonableness match with the fact that his grace is not enough for some people to escape eternal damnation?
Because everybody deserves damnation, because everyone was corporately in Adam, so we all committed the original sin. This is his claim. Whether any of us like it, that's how he tries to deal with it. Yeah. He thinks he is bound by scripture on these questions. Right? So there are people in hell, there are, so he's working within parameters. And then he's committed to the view that God is eminently reasonable at the same time, not so much because it's in the Bible, but just because of Greek philosophy and Roman philosophy. Anyone else?
Do they ever answer that question, perhaps, this whole issue that we're having, as a result of maybe a duality, maybe perhaps, whether they're getting into the issue of whether or not God is omnipotent then, because like you said, if you had the power to give you legs, and you just give you legs, you wouldn't just give you a wheelchair, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do any of them ever really get into duality, that perhaps there's just a good and evil, and perhaps that's why God is just pushing you towards the good, but it's not, I'm trying to say.
Are you giving a Manichaean view, where there's a good power or God and a bad one?
Do they address it in the form of a duality, or do they just say,
well, it's not God.
We just won't know why he does the way he does.
does. It's neither, you know, we don't want to say it's there's good and evil forces. There's just God.
Right. No.
It's
so,
not
so,
it.
So when Augustine
like,
was a manichee,
for
about 10 years, he thought there were two gods, good and evil, basically evenly matched. And so God was omnipotent. This explains why there are all kinds of bad things in the world. This explains why we sin. We have too much of the bad. Well, they thought each god was material. So the worst kind of matter that makes up the evil god, I have more of that in me, and that's why I do bad things. So I can explain why I have these addictions that I can't overcome. It's because of my biochemical constitution. But then he ultimately rejected that, right, for a platonic view, which is also a monotheistic view, that there's only one God, he's omnipotent. So there has to be a reason why God does what he does, even though he could give us legs, he doesn't. But we don't know what the reason is. And he speculates. Like, I mean, there, many good things can come out of it, for example. Like what happened with him having to move because of his bad students. Eventually, like, something very good came out of it, right?
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying? Because it just seems like all these issues are coming out of as, out of this monotheistic framework. Like,
yeah.
Once you stick to it,
yeah, we
all
just
these questions
just
kind of come, yeah, so. But, I mean, if you want to obviously stick to that and you have that monotheistic conviction, then
yeah.
There are certain things that you just
right, exactly.
Bring into these problems.
And he thinks it's a metaphysical, like, he just thinks of dualism of the Manichee type is metaphysically untenable. So it's not just like a conviction or belief, it's just there's really no other workable metaphysics. Yes?
Does he comment at all about, I know he comments about existence being objectively good, but even damned existence being better than non-existing? So to go back to your previous comment, I don't remember exactly where in the New Testament, but somewhere Jesus, I think, comments, better not to exist than to tempt a little child or to do something bad, or...
That I have a millstone thrown around his neck and cast into the sea.
Sure. I seem to remember that somewhere there is something of better not to exist, but maybe I'm remembering...
Better not to exist? That he had never been born. Better for him than he had never
been born. Exactly. So what's the comment on that? If all people are damned, is damnation better than not existing?
Yeah, I mean, to exist, I mean, damnation is a state that you're in, right? But to exist as a creature is better than not existing at all. But it's a bad state that you're in, to put it mildly.
It just seems hard to palate if he's operating within the Bible's framework of what hell looks like.
That you mean that particular quote, it'd be better for him that he'd never been born?
Both that particular quote and just generally what the way hell is described in the Bible.
Oh,
it sounds like it's... would be preferable to non-existent to be there.
Yeah, I mean, ontologically, it's better to exist than not to exist, but that doesn't mean you enjoy life more if you exist in hell than not at all, right? Because if you don't exist, you don't have any experiences whatsoever. But the ontological point is that when he's saying it's better to exist than not at all, he's just making the ontological point. He's not saying... it's better to have a really, really bad quality of life than to not have any quality of life at all. Yes?
Professor Byers, thank you for your lecture.
You.
Just want to find out whether, we're in the biblical, whether any of the Reformation debaters, whether they be Protestant or Catholic, may have been erring on the side of voluntarism, stemming from nominalism at all,
no.
In sort of consideration of the Beatitico, which is consideration of power as first and foremost sort of a fatherly, medicinal, reparative kind of usage of God's power,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to perhaps something that was more via moderna, the later consideration of power, God's omnipotence, and God boots down the door, turns on the lights, and here you go. So I was wondering if their considerations at all, do you see any voluntarism in that at all?
Well, I mean, I think the Dominicans think that the Jesuits are voluntarists, and they're Pelagians, and they call them Pelagians, semi-Pelagians. So, because that's effectively what they're saying, you know, God gives, so Melina's position is God predicts what you will respond well to, and God just gives you this attractive presentation. And that's all it takes for you to make this activism on your own. So you could say you are saving yourself, because what saves you is the decision, right, to be converted to God. And God does not give you that. God just gives you the preamble, right? But he says explicitly at one point, you could reject it. So it's not intrinsically efficacious, although when he's debating with the Dominicans, he sometimes wants to claim that it is, and because God just tends not to make mistakes and predicting how people are going to react to it. But in principle, the person could reject it, right? And he thinks you have to say this to preserve human free will, but, I mean, I think any anti-Pelagian would call that a voluntarist position. Thank you all. It's been great. Very interesting conversation. Thank you.